Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
David Cross is a tremendously talented comedian, writer, producer, author, and actor based in Brooklyn, New York. Emmy-winning and Grammy-nominated, Cross is beloved for his work as a stand-up and as a creative force on pioneering television programs like Mr. Show with Bob and David, Arrested Development, and Todd Margaret. And you've likely seen him or heard his voice in shows and films like Station 11, Genius Aretha, The Post, Men in Black, I'm Not There, and Megamind, among many others. He wrote a New York Times bestseller with I Drink for a Reason, and his comedy albums and specials, including Shut Up You Fucking Baby, It's Not Funny, and Oh Come On, contain some of the funniest stand-up of this century. His latest special is called I'm From the Future, which was filmed at the Bell House in Brooklyn in November 2021, and as Cross financed its production and release himself, it's currently only available to rent at officialdavidcross.com. David returns to this show for another extensive chat, this time about things like his love of New York City and New Yorkers, his wife Amber Tamblyn's forthcoming book, his experience being stuck in Toronto during some of the pandemic, how Canada handled it compared to New York, and his opinion of Ontario Premier Doug Ford, dark satire and having hope, his long and great relationship with Bob Odenkirk, and thoughts on Bob's recent memoir, Comedy, Comedy, Comedy Drama, and his stellar work on the show Better Call Saul, how great the acting on Mr. Show really was, a new collaboration with Odenkirk, other future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 694 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented David Cross with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, David. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Vish?
I'm well, thank you. Where in the world are you?
I'm in New York, Brooklyn, New York, at my home.
Nice. You have been in Brooklyn for a long time now? How long exactly?
I wanted to get here in time for Hurricane Sandy, so I kind of rushed that, and I got in just in time, just in the nick of time for Hurricane Sandy. I've been in Brooklyn for going on 12 years. 11 years, sorry.
Yeah, wait, 2011? Is that what you meant? 2011. When was Hurricane Sandy?
Yeah. 2011, yeah. Sorry. 2011. I mixed my 9/11s and my Hurricane Sandys.
Yeah, that's true. Every 10 years on the ones, there's a horrible disaster, yeah. I'm sorry, were you particularly adversely impacted by the hurricane? I know some people lost everything.
I was, yeah. I did not lose everything, and it was, I'm lucky to have insurance and stuff, but yeah, I lost, lost is a bit dramatic. I lost my car, and it was actually an AP photo, and somebody took video of it from their apartment, but it got swept down one street, turned around up, about halfway up another street, and it was my area got like really badly hit, and the insurance guy, it was a couple days later, and you know, tons of cars. I don't know if you ever saw that, the overhead photo of the cars in wherever it was in Long Island or something, but you know, tens of thousands of just trashed vehicles and trees, you know, crushing some. And because cars, you know, rely so much on electronics these days, the salty, you know, seawater, I guess it was a bit of a mix of river and sea, but it was, you know, filled to the top. And you could see the residue, the water line on the top of the windows. And the insurance guy just came and literally just looked at it. And I met him at the car, and he just wrote a claim thing, just gave it to me, tore it off, and went on to do the next one.
Right.
There was no discussion. He just looked at it and went, yep, here you go. So I switched my, whatever it was, 2007 GMC Acadia for a 2012 Toyota Highlander flex fuel, whatever it was.
So a blessing in disguise? I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. That's horrible.
It was a lateral move. I'd say it's a lateral move.
That's the perils of living in New York. You were in Los Angeles, I presume, before that.
I was in L.A., yeah, and I was in L.A. for 9.5 years, but pretty much the entire time my philosophy was I moved to L.A. so that I could get established in my career and make enough money to move away from L.A. And never have to live there again. Yeah. So I moved to New York in spring of 2001.
I see. Now, I mean, that's the center of the industry you're in, LA, I mean. But did you feel like you were at any disadvantage being away from it? Because I can understand your disdain for LA. I appreciate
well,
that.
Well, it's not. I think people misunderstand my feelings about LA. I don't have disdain for it. I don't like it. I have tons of friends there, and there's nice things to do. LA's good if you've got money. If you don't have money, it's not that great. Unlike New York, which is also good if you have money, but there are all kinds of things to avail oneself of that don't particularly cost a lot of money. Rent is crazy here, mm-hmm. but rent is also crazy in LA. You get more yeah. space for your money, but you don't spend that much time inside in New York. You know, you tend to, you know, unless the weather is not cooperating, you tend to spend time out of your apartment, and there's all kinds of cool things to do. You can bike everywhere, and you can't say that about LA. And LA is, I get why people like it. I just don't care for those things that I don't like the weather there. I prefer the weather in New York. I like four seasons. I don't like 1 1/4 season. It's dirty there. Not that New York isn't dirty, but LA is dirty in the sense that there's dirt, there's smog, there's grit.
Oh,
there's,
I see.
There's just a thin layer of nasty dirt on everything. And the greens aren't as green. The trees aren't as green. The sky isn't as blue. Huh. And you have to drive virtually everywhere, which I don't care for.
And that contributes to the grit, I would yeah. I'm getting the smog and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's a poorly planned city, and I like biking everywhere. I like public transportation. I've taken the subway a couple times in L.A., and it was okay when I had to go from a point A to point B, and they were kind of conveniently located. But outside of that, it's not that great. And, you know, it's just not my thing. And I love New York. That's the other thing. Yeah. I love New York. And I there aren't that many cities that I love, but I really love New York. A day doesn't go by when I'm not thankful that I get to be here. And I love it here. And this is where I always wanted to live.
You take some pride in New York in your new special, which is amazing, by the way. I love it so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so funny.
Thank you.
You make a point.
Tell the listeners where they can check it out.
I believe it's
DavidCross.com.
Is that correct? Is that the best place?
Official David Cross. Because there were other pretenders to the throne.
I see. Sorry. Official David Cross. I usually save the plugging till the end, but I appreciate you intervening. Sorry about that. OfficialDavidCross.com is where people could find the special, which you've independently released. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. I funded the whole thing. I produced it. I paid for everything. I'm self-distributing it for a couple reasons. The main reason was because not all of it, but I'd say a good, I don't know, 35 to 40% of the material is pretty topical mm-hmm. and relevant to the times we're in now. And when I sent it out, you know, I've put specials out on Netflix and Epix and Stars and HBO and Comedy Central. And when I went out with this, you know, most of the responses were, in part because of COVID, backed everything up, but they were like, okay, well, we could slot you in. I think the earliest I got, I taped this in November 7th and 8th of 2021, and was like third quarter of 2023 or 2022, or a couple other people were like, yeah, we have stuff available in 2023. I'm like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's way too long. And, you know, I know a number of people are doing this model, and I kind of used like Louis C.K.'s template, and a number of other people have done it.
Yeah.
And I already have the website. It exists.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I put it up there, and hopefully I will make my money back, you know?
You know, back in the day, if a record label or a company like the ones you're describing said, oh, we can't do that right away because we got to manufacture it and blah, blah, blah. Why would there be any delay if you were saying, I finished a thing, there's not a physical aspect to this, it could go up at any point. What is their pipeline problem that I don't understand?
That is the $64,000 question. That is a great question. I don't know. I never got a satisfactory answer, except just that's how it's done. That's what they've got. And they've got X amount of comedy specials, you know, lined up. And they've got X amount of, you know, dramatic one-offs and X amount of, you know, serialized shows and X amount of whatever to roll out. But it's a really good question. Like, why, what does it matter? You know, it's all based on an algorithm. You're not taking up any space except for a pretend space in outer space. You know, it's a bandwidth. It lives on a server somewhere. I don't know the answer to that. It's a really good question.
Well, I'll advocate on behalf of some people here by suggesting, because I deal with this sometimes with people with books, publishers, publicists for books. You know, if I say, hey, I have the author of that book you guys put out 2 months ago on my show, they say, oh, we're done. We don't promote that book anymore. We had a run and that's it. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, what's the, it's a book. It's a book. Yeah. Like the person spent like 2 years probably writing that book. What's two? And they're like, yeah, we just, that's it. So all I'm getting at is to advocate. I think what their rationale is, we have limited personnel with limited time, and we can't squeeze or shoehorn extra promotion in. By the way, all that is to me is just hit retweet. I'm not asking you to write anything. Just share the thing. Sorry, I get a little thirsty with this stuff.
No, I don't even know. Like, Netflix barely promotes anything.
I know.
I mean, they're infamous for not promoting stuff.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, that doesn't even apply to them. But I don't know the answer. I mean, and books are worse. My wife is an author, has another book coming out in October, but she finished that, you know, half a year ago.
Yeah.
And they need like a year to, from when you finish it to like, okay, we'll release it a year from now. And okay, why? Well, they just need that time. And that's how it is in publishing. It's worse. You know, I've watched her go through it a number of times.
Yeah.
And they have a deadline. She has a deadline. She's got to go, you know, I've locked herself in a room for 3 weeks before the deadline. And you're making this deadline, but the book's not going to come out for a year.
Yeah. Yeah, that, okay, so a physical book or a physical record or something means a production these days. I get it a little bit. I get that a little bit more, but it's not tied to that. You're right. If they really wanted to, they'd be like, you're done your book? Okay, we'll send it off to the press tomorrow. They could do that. But and I get it. Again, I'm trying to advocate on timelines and all that stuff. But hey, by the way, can you tell the people listening who your wife is? And maybe do you want to plug the book? Is it too early to plug the book coming out in October? I don't want to leave that behind.
No, I'm happy to. My wife is Michelle Obama, and she's got a new memoir that was ghostwritten by... No. My wife is Amber Tamblyn, and she has a book of essays. I'm almost positive she settled on a title. I should remember it. It's...
Is she in the house? Can you text her? What's going on?
Yeah, I can text her.
Just ask her the title. Yeah. Well, no, that's so it's a book of essays. That's interesting.
Yeah, about women's intuition.
That's very fascinating.
Your new book.
I like this.
I will tell you in a second.
No, that's fine. I appreciate that. That's great. As she's a, you're saying she's a, this is not her first book, is what you were kind of intimating. Is that correct?
No. She's got several books. She's got, four books of poetry, I think. Four books of poetry. It's called, here, she just texted me. It's called Listening in the Dark.
Listening in the Dark. I see.
Yep. By Amber Tamblyn. Well, edited by Amber Tamblyn. And I will give you the publisher as well in a second. Listening in the Dark, a collection of essays. It's all women shit. It's all feminist, you know, I mean, whining? Is whining a good word?
No, it can't be. This is not a good blurb. Did you blurb that book? Please don't.
Yes.
That's what it says on the back.
That's my blurb for the back cover.
It's just a bunch of whining, Harper, David Cross. Yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of women bitching about men. another book where
I'm not touching this. I did touch it, but I'm backing away. No, it sounds very interesting, if I might say. To get us
back.
Okay.
No, it's and she's got a great list of writers and some professional writers, some not. Be Park Row Books by which is a HarperCollins subsidiary imprint. That's where it's coming out. It's called Listening in the Dark, and it'll be edited by Amber Tamblyn. So pick it up.
Well, she's shoot, maybe I should reach out to my HarperCollins people and see about getting Amber on the show, if possible. That would
do for sure. Absolutely,
that sounds interesting. Now, where was I going with what I was talking about before? Oh yeah, New York. So on your special, you advocate.
We're going way back.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry, we're going back 5 minutes.
That's right.
No, you advocate for bike riding, which I thought was really great. You shot your special at the Bell House, which is a lovely venue I've been to just the one time a few years.
Oh, it's great, and I bike. I'm doing shows to prepare, to get new material for the next time I go out. And then I bike everywhere. I bike to all my shows, except for the Manhattan ones. There's some, just because they end too late and I don't want to ride over the bridge and all that, because I got to get up early with I got a 5-year-old. So,
yeah.
But all the Brooklyn shows, I ride my bike. It's great.
No, an amazing, I just like that you point that out. Maybe some people will take that into consideration, maybe I could be biking around. It's good. But the other point I was going to raise is you talk about New York and the way New Yorkers reacted to the pandemic as in relation to the rest of your country, which, by the way, for those listening, the United States of America. So can you expand?
Oh, no. I'm so sorry, Bish. I live in Little New York.
Sorry.
In BC. It's a little section. It's a block long, and it's just got dog shit everywhere.
Hey, by the way, in the special, and I don't know if you ended up ever elaborating upon it, but you were trapped in Canada during the pandemic? You talked about that.
I was.
Why was that again?
I don't know if you heard. It was this thing called COVID.
No. Sorry. Why were you in Canada is what I was getting at there. I assume you're doing a film. No. I live in Alberta now. I moved. From Ontario.
Why'd you move?
It's a common question I get. In that tone, why? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
I my wife's family is from here, and also in Ontario, real estate market is prohibitive. We were middle,
it's crazy.
Yeah, we have two children now, and we had a 2-bedroom house we owned, but we couldn't. Yeah. We would bid on, 15 houses and get outbid by people from Toronto. Lived in a small town outside of Toronto, an hour outside of Toronto, called Guelph. And that's where you and I have talked from before, that's where I was anyway. And anyway, couldn't afford to move. And then the job market we couldn't find work that didn't have us commuting to Toronto, which is one of the most expensive cities to live in as well. Didn't want to live.
It's nuts, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it. And then better, higher paying jobs beckoned. And again, Michelle.
Yeah, I get it.
My parents are in Ontario, but Michelle kind of did her time in Ontario away from her family, and her brothers all have kids. Anyway, it made sense at the time. But then Alberta, during the pandemic, showed itself to be like America. Not really dealing with the issue in a
well, Toronto was pretty bad. I thought, I mean, and I don't know that you could fuck up more than Doug Ford fucked up, like repeatedly and consistently. And the press conference he had where he started crying, which I watched, I mean, it was infuriating, and I've never seen. Been in the place where this happened before, where twice in a 1-week period, Doug Ford, announced this edict, and the cops twice said, "We're not going to do that." Twice,
yeah.
The police, when he said there were two things. One was One was the drinking. No, one was just the first one was about stopping people. This is way into the fucking, you know, lockdown, yeah, stay at home order, right, stuff. Way into it. The after the winter, which wasn't particularly harsh, but you know, it's a Toronto winter. It's not great, and you know, people
spring,
were
spring summer 2020. Are we talking right now?
No, winter spring 21.
Oh, 2021. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We went up there in mid-January. And the reason, so we went up there because my wife was working on a show. And initially, before COVID, it was just going to be the greatest situation. As I said, we had a daughter who was four at the start of it. No, three at the start, three and a half. And about to turn four. And initially, it was going to be my wife had it in her contract that she would have Fridays or Mondays off so she could come home. It's a quick flight, Toronto, New York, it's nothing. And, you know, and she was a part of this large ensemble show, so she had all this time off. And it was just ideal. And then COVID hit, but it wasn't that bad in Canada, but it was extremely bad initially in New York, yeah, and we, yeah, were the kind of gateway
epicenter, you know, for quite a while. Yeah,
we were the epicenter, and nobody knew what was going on. There was no, obviously no vaccine yet, and I mean, it was, I talk about in the special the freezer trucks, the mobile freezer trucks with bodies and the makeshift graves. It was unlike anything I've ever experienced. It was crazy, and people, it was scary, you know, for a good month of, and nobody knew what to do. And we were just learning piecemeal the little bits of information. And sometimes, you know, 20% of that information that you get would be corrected within, you know, 3 days. Oh, we had it wrong. It's actually, you know.
Yeah.
And so the idea was like, okay, we'll just take the family up to Toronto. And that's what we'll do. And I was happy. I had no work here. And I was like, great, I'll do, you know, I love Toronto. I'll just get a residency somewhere and then just do stand-up. I recorded an album in Toronto. I've had really fun shows. I like the city a lot. And yeah, and so we were looking forward to it, you know, like, we'll just go up there and you do your work and we'll have plenty of time off, and I'll just go do sets. And then in the interim of planning that, and, you know, getting an Airbnb and figuring all the stuff out, COVID made it to Canada. And you know, the reactions were mixed at best. And Doug Ford was just terrible. I mean, nothing shocks me anymore in the world of politics, but I will be really surprised if he gets reelected.
He did. And
so that happened, and he got reelected
last week. As we're speaking, those listening, it was 2 weeks ago. But yeah, last week he got reelected. And I was following it. Sorry, I didn't even get to that part of it. And it's a little...
I mean, I'm just...
Yeah, no.
I'm amazed.
You remember his brother, right? Rob Ford,
yeah,
mayor?
Of course, yeah. I smoked crack with him a million times. Not a million, but I mean, that's an exaggeration, but seven times.
I understand. I understand how hyperbole works, but my point is this. It's baffling. We moved to a place that had the furthest right political party in power in Canada. They made up a party. It wasn't, the Conservative Party wasn't far right enough. So the party here in Alberta is the, I don't even know what they're called, the UCP, United Conservative Party, I want to say. I always say Ultra Conservative Party, but it's the United Conservative Party. And
Uber
Conservative Party. That sounds like a
ride. Uber-alis.
It's like a ride service. But anyway, yeah, they came into power after this province elected the furthest left government that we, rather party that we have, really, the NDP, maybe not the furthest left, but pretty close. And that's after like 60 years of Conservative rule. So in my mind, I'm like, yes, we're leaving Doug Ford's Ontario, which was a factor, by the way, I will say. Politically, yeah. I'm like, we can't do this. But I also was like, this is worse. We're going to a worse place. But they just had a far left. Sorry, I'm giving you some of my political stripes here. They just had a conscious party in power. Maybe it'll oscillate back. But I don't know what to make of anything anymore, because democracy is very frustrating. And, you know, it was like, I can't remember what the, it was like 18% of the people in Ontario voted total. It's like some like eligible voters, like no one cared. And yet Ford won. I might be fudging that number, but it was a very low voter turnout and Doug Ford won.
Well, that's what you get. That's what you get. So nobody has a right to complain. Unless you voted for, no, even if you voted for Ford, you have a right to complain. But unless you voted, you have a right. But yes, so 82% of those the people should shut the fuck up if you don't go vote.
Yeah, it's a. I'm sorry you. Well, I'm glad you got to experience a little bit of Canada, because sometimes you guys, you think we got it so good up here. Oh, I'll go to Canada whenever like someone bad is elected president.
That's true. That's true.
We hear that. Oh, I'm going to move to Canada. You know, like Alec Baldwin will say that.
Well, yeah, I don't think he's the.
So I get it. Anyway, yeah, I appreciate that.
And guess what? Alec Baldwin is not going to move to Canada ever. Ever.
He probably can't now. He's probably under some sort of watch. Anyway, yeah. That's a whole other topic. But my point was going to be, what was my point? You advocate for New Yorkers in America.
Well, I've talked over the years, I've talked about how New Yorkers responded to 9/11, how they responded to the blackouts that came that were very scary on the heels of 9/11, and how everybody, New Yorkers are very helpful and and civic, they're certainly brusque. It can be very brusque, but they are some of the most helpful people I've ever lived amongst. And I've lived in a lot of different places, but there's a real serious sense of community, whether you're talking about a borough, the city itself, a borough, or just your block, you know. And just seeing yet again the way New Yorkers responded to the pandemic. And it was baffling seeing so many people, in Toronto too, you know, we're not going to wear a mask. Fuck you. You know, don't tell me what to do. And just a complete selfish lack of concern for other people, which when you distill it, it's just that. That's what, I'm not going to do this thing, but whatever your reasons are, anti-government, it's an overreach or whatever the thing is, even though you've been told empirical and factual information, like just the refusal, based on this kind of misguided, selfish principle. And, and New Yorkers didn't do that for the most part. And then we got to open up. I was in Toronto, and let me tell you, this is it was a seriously, it was a tough time for us. It was hard on our marriage, being locked in this house with a 4-year-old and quarantining and not being allowed out and for 6 months. Well, 5 months. My wife has stayed for, we left the second we could get out. I mean, literally the second I took my daughter and we went back to New York where everything was open. Right. Everything. We have open streets now. We have this thing called open streets where they close down the streets of traffic and everybody goes out. You eat and drink. It's very European.
Right.
And, just people enjoying themselves and still, you know, wearing masks if they have to, but things opening up and in the interim, and you know, while I'm up in Toronto, and my wife was like, look, just go, you know, go somewhere and do a week somewhere, just go get work. I mean, do it for your own head. And it was really tough. I had a difficult time with it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And, I mean, as I think a lot of people did, but, and then everything, I was calling literally Alberta. I was looking at clubs, going online, anywhere, going Vancouver, Calgary, Regina, Edmonton, Winnipeg. I was looking everywhere. And nothing is open. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do. And
but
surely Yellowknife. Yellowknife must have something. I will walk to Yellowknife. And then, in the meantime, I'm talking to friends of mine. I was talking to Bob Odenkirk, and he's like, yeah, I did a set at, it was really fun. I jumped on, you know, Janine's show at the thing, and it was great. And I'm like, oh, my God. Mm. And I couldn't, there's no back and forth because you'd have to quarantine.
Yeah.
And not just quarantine, but you have to go to the airport hotels that were mandated 3 days at the Toronto airport DoubleTree or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go home, and then they would send people. They were serious, like, we're going to send people to where you're staying, and if you're not there, you know, we'll kick you out, or you'll be fine, or you go to jail, or whatever. And there was nowhere to go, nothing to do.
And, so just to intervene, though, but I'm trying to parse out what you're saying. Are you saying, because I gather you're saying there was sort of a potentially overreach here in Canada, mm-hmm, compared to what your friends were going through in the States. However, was that precipitated by how much bungling of the situation was done here? Or did you just think, why are these Canadians being so overcautious? Or was your mind, like, because
I didn't think it was overcautious. I think it was, if all this is to say, everything I'm saying is, if everybody in Toronto or Ontario had adhered to a mask mandate,
right. Yeah.
had done, that's what I'm saying. In New York, they told us to do, and it's what I talk about in the special,
yes,
albeit in a much funnier way, laughter.
What could be funnier than this? Yeah, yeah.
This conversation is a little drier than, but anyway.
Sorry, is this my fault? I didn't mean to do this.
No,
I'm
it's
doing
all right.
My best here.
I'm not trying to put on a show, but you know, as I talk about, and this was a real thing. The junkies wore masks.
Yes,
and the junkies, as I said, I live around the corner from a treatment center, and everybody wore a mask. We did the minimal stuff, and we're one of the most vaccinated states in the country. The fourth most, fifth most, I don't know, outside of like Maine and Vermont.
Yep. Yep.
You know, the blue states here, and we're like, oh, a free vaccine that we know works. Okay, we'll take it. Thank you. And you know, just to watch the rest of the country react the way they did, and like, oh, you're messing it up for everyone. But that is to say why I was frustrated in Toronto too, because people just didn't wear masks.
Yeah.
I remember, okay, so I had this, when they opened up a little bit towards the early spring, things got a little looser, like nothing, in fact, there were 2 weeks in March, I believe, early mid-March, where they kind of opened things up with the 6-foot space, you know, and there was a bar on, maybe it was Queen, but there was a place that was great, that had this outdoor backyard area. And so for 2 weeks, even though it was cold, we'd bundle up and we'd go get beers and just be outside and be with other people drinking beer, and you know, and that went away after 2 weeks. They rescinded that,
right,
because I think people just didn't, they're like, okay, we can do this, but you still have to stay 6 feet apart and you still have to wear masks, but we can do this. And then people just didn't do it.
Right.
And so then they took it away,
right,
for people's safety, because people were dying. And it was just a frustrating thing to be a part of, because I was like, I did everything you're supposed to do. And my wife did everything you're supposed to do. And I come from a place where I know it works. Mm. And I went, when they opened this thing up, I went to one of those office, you know, where you get your own little room. Office rental,
yep,
places,
yep,
temporary. I'm sure there's an umbrella term for it, but
like an office B&B or something. Yeah, sure. I don't know what they're called, but yeah.
Sure. Well, that's not it, but you know what I mean. Like a WeWork place,
yeah,
but
that's
I don't
right.
want to say
yeah.
WeWork.
Yeah,
but
like
that kind of idea. So yeah. I got a place just to be able to get out of the house and walk through the park. I was right near Trinity Bellwood Park. And,
oh, nice.
And just go, just be able to be somewhere else. When my daughter, you know, we got like a temporary nanny, part-time nanny, and I would just go and just try to write, you know, or do mm-hmm. something or change my scenery. And of course, you know, wearing a mask when I'm in a public area, and there was a woman, I'm going to guess early, mid-30s, who was had her office established there. She was all set up when I got there. And she wrote a note and put it under my door saying, "Hi, you know, my name is whatever, and hopefully we'll be able to meet, you know, in a in better situation. But if you see me in the office not wearing a mask, it's because I have PTSD and I can't wear a mask." That's bullshit. PTSD. That's made up.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. You know, unless she was attacked by masks or something. But why? Or a mask was forced on her when she was a child. Whatever. Yeah. It's a bullshit excuse. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not talking about duct tape. We're not talking about a pillowcase with eye holes cut out. We're talking about a light strip of cloth.
There's a run in your special where I could not stop laughing. I've watched your special twice and I laughed at this the same amount, if I may, where you go on that run about the equivalence of wearing a mask. Like what struggles there are. And yeah, I here's where I'm going to go with this a little bit. Are you familiar with this political satire duo, the Good Liars? Do you know them?
Yes. I don't know them personally, but I know their
tweets. Yes, and they're funny. And what they do, for those who don't know, they're a couple of guys, and they go, they're very brave, I would say, because they keep doing it and no one seems to recognize them. But they go to these MAGA rallies and they try to highlight the idiocy and the hypocrisy and the foolishness of people.
Well, the one they just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but they just did one at a NRA, whatever that was, a week ago or so. That was really ballsy.
The one where Jason confronts Wayne LaPierre directly.
Well,
that one?
Yeah, where he goes and he's lauding him. He's like, you know, you're just, what you're doing is great, and he starts, and then he, you know, turns it at the end. But holy moly, that's pretty ballsy.
Yeah, Jason Selwig, I believe, is the fella's name. I don't know them myself, but basically, for those who haven't seen it, yeah, he really takes thoughts and prayers, that expression, and really goes to town on Wayne LaPierre.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, but where I'm coming from, David, is that a friend of mine on Twitter, his name's John Semley, retweeted one of the Good Liars bits, and it's one where they're at a MAGA rally or something, and they're trying to get a guy, an older guy who's a MAGA guy, to go on the record saying he's against slavery. That's that's the gist of it, and they can't get him to do it because the guy just doesn't understand. But my friend John tweeted something like, "What's the point of this?" At some, like, just to the, there's a level of satire where I think people are like, "What are we doing with, like, what is, we understand that these people are horrible, but what are we doing?" And I love the Good Liars myself. I'm like, "Huh, yeah, what are we doing? We know these people are deplorable, if you will. Where are we going with this?" And I bring this to you because I think in your comedy, which I love, you have pointed out hypocrisy and idiocy. And for a long time for me, particularly the last 20 years, definitely post 9/11, I have taken great comfort in that. At that release valve of like, holy fuck, everyone sucks. And someone is articulating this in such a funny way. But at this point, like, where I think even the right, it doesn't impact them in a way where they're like, "Oh yeah, we're fucking assholes. They're right." They just double down. So all I'm getting at is, do you still get the same satisfaction in doing a special like yours, if you ever did, in sort of highlighting these things? Because I don't get the sense that you're like, "I'm going to change the world with my comedy. I'm going to change people's minds."
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. It's catharsis and it's comforting, I think. Back during the Bush administration, when I was touring around the country, the feeling I got and the sentiment that was expressed to me by people, you know, fans or new fans when I go somewhere that was more like where I grew up, which was Georgia, you'd get a real sense, again, because they would express this, that I'm glad there's somebody else that thinks like this and that is not in the majority because I am in New York. I'm in a progressive. I choose to be in this, and I can afford to be in a liberal progressive city in a liberal progressive state. I mean, again, it's relative, but certainly the rest of the United States. And when you go to Macon, Georgia, or you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, or outside of Louisville, Kentucky, or someplace like that, where people are not in the majority, they're in the minority, and they're just, for at least for 90 minutes, one night, there's a guy that's coming in, and they can sit amongst other people, you know, let's say 1,200 other people, and they can that feel like, oh, there's a empowerment there, and it's a relief. And I know that my comedy can give them that feeling, at least yeah. for a night, you know. And, you know, maybe people make friends that with people, like-minded people that are at the show. And I've, at numerous shows, depending on the time of the year when it's happening, I've done voter registration drives up out in the lobby. And perhaps people come together, and especially if you're in a smaller, more conservative area. And look, that's just a happy byproduct. That's not my intent. You know, I go out. It's kind of easy on one level to do what I do in Brooklyn. You know, and I love touring. It's one of my favorite things to do. I love stand up. I love touring. I love traveling. Yeah. And that's just one of the nice byproducts of going to a tougher. And you know, not believe me, not everybody in the audience is like-minded. When I was doing the Make America Great Again tour, I mean, I had walkouts virtually every single night. I think I did 111 shows in that tour. Yeah. And I'm not including Europe or Canada, but in the States for sure, I'd say virtually every show there were people who walked out, sometimes quietly and sometimes very noisily.
Huh. So, okay, and I appreciate that. It sounds to me like you're aware of the fact that what you're doing provides a balm for like-minded people. Do you ever hear that you've changed a mind, or do you, I know, again, it's very exalted and lofty to assume that you telling jokes might change someone's mind. I had Jeff Tweedy from Wilco on the show recently, like last week. And,
I changed Jeff Tweedy's mind. He was pro slavery. And then I did a set, this is going way back. And he said, you opened my eyes. There should not be slavery, He said slavery bad.
I've gone on record before. I think Wilco's concept album, the pro-slavery concept album, was a mistake. I think it's a misstep in their career, and I think
it was ballsy, but
It was brave on the one hand, but maybe misguided on the other. My point is, at one point I was talking to him about this. I'd like to talk to Americans and Canadians about what the hell's going on in our lives. And he said he has hope. He has hope. He has hope because his late father was so repulsed by what Trump was saying. And it was more along the lines of his dad being such a ardent, hardworking, working class guy that he resented Trump for being the boss's son. And then also attacking migrants and immigrants. And because his father, who he said he would not have agreed with for most of his life, by the end of his life had changed, had evolved, it gave him hope that to him, the problems, gun control, the solutions are so evident that he believes at some point things will change. And I can't tell, for those of us who love David Cross, the one word that is synonymous with David Cross is hope. Do you have hope, David, that things could change, that people, the selfishness that you've been talking about, the assholery, even in Toronto, Canada, which is supposed to, you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, and my answer is different now than it would have been 5.5 years ago. And I've been asked this before, and I would say to you that I have hope because I have to have hope. I don't have the luxury of not having hope because I have a 5-year-old daughter. And if I thought there was no hope, and I continued down the cynical path that I was on, which I understandably, based on the evidence before me, I can't do that with a kid.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that to her. And I find myself surprising myself pretty often. Like the guy I was when I was in my 20s, the ideas I had about, not that I ever articulated this, but I'm presuming if I was confronted with it when I was like 23, like, yeah. If I had a kid, I wouldn't tell him about Santa Claus. I'd tell him exactly what's going on. Like, any of that kind of concept is out the window. I am a Jew who, I was raised Jewish, and I'm an atheist. I was fairly early on, and I have a Christmas tree. We decorate it, talk about Santa, and that you can extrapolate that into things going on in the future as she gets more cognizant and aware of things. And I will continue to find the upside and the wonderment and the beautiful and hope in everything I can now because of her.
I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting. I've been very intrigued by, like, when George Carlin's daughter, I want to say, is on Twitter, or Robin Williams's daughter. It's very fascinating, like, to see the offspring kind of revisiting their parents' oldest material. And someone like Carlin is always trending, you know, because he said something at some point that resonates today. So
yep. It
is interesting. I think about it too with my kids. Like, we have these weird legacies we have to be mindful of now, maybe.
I don't care about my legacy. I don't. I probably did.
I don't mean in terms of, like, socioculturally, but like your children. You've done so much
yes.
stuff.
Yes. Oh, that legacy.
What I'm
yes.
saying is, you've done, like, I'm looking behind right. you, and I can see some evidence of some of the work you've done in terms of TV and whatnot, in terms of posters and whatnot. And what I'm saying is, like, we've done all, and I've, on a much smaller scale, have made these things that, unless the internet falls apart, will always be around, you know, and you've got the
God,
same.
I hope the internet falls apart.
So that's what I'm getting at. I do think what you're saying is parenting changes you. And that sounds hokey, I imagine, to some people, but it really does.
Well, better.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I never, when I was younger, and I, not that much younger, because the example I'm going to cite is, but I remember seeing an interview with Matt Damon and early on, and not even to pick him out specifically, but because a million different people have expressed this, but he was the one I read the interview with who asked if success changed him. And he said, no, I'm still the same guy. And that's either you're lying or you're just not very self-aware, because of course it changes you. Mm. It changes every single person. The idea of not having money and having money, is completely changes your life and your world and your perception. And especially for the people who forget or want to forget or speed up the forgetfulness of what it's like to not have money. And so having a kid better change you.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I appreciate that. I just read, or a couple months ago, I guess, I finished your friend Bob Odenkirk's book,
mm-hmm.
which for those, we're plugging a lot of books today. Comedy, 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 drama, I believe is, mm-hmm. I think I got the right number of comedies there. You blurb the book, I think, in a more fulsome way than the blurb we discussed for Amber's book earlier.
Sure.
Did anything about that book, I assume you read it. Did you read it or did you just blurb it for fun?
I read it twice. I read his, you know, the galley copy,
yeah.
You know, just to sort of give him my impressions and stuff before it was locked, as they call it.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, whatever it was, 9 months later, I got the finished book and I read it again.
It's great. I loved it. And I want to ask about your impressions of the way he told his story and maybe if you had any surprises there. But I will say also, I just don't want to lose this thread. It prompted me to rewatch Mr. Show. And I have some thoughts about that too. But let's go to the book first. Sorry, it's a jumbled question. Did anything about Bob's book in any iteration that you read surprise you per se? Was there anything about what he divulged that you were like, oh, didn't think he was going to go, you know, present that?
Well, not in the sense that I didn't think he'd say something that he said that I was aware of, but the only thing that was kind of, I wouldn't say revelatory, but he always kind of downplayed stand-up in as a role in his development. And in the book, he describes doing stand-up and doing more stand-up than I ever thought he ever did. That isn't to say he did a ton of it, but it was more than I was led to believe. And he actually did, you know, went out and hit the road a couple times, which, that's like literally the only thing. I mean, I've known the guy. Yeah. He's, you know, one of my best friends, and I've known him for a long, long time. And so a lot of that stuff I knew. I didn't know the full... The story as he told it about running into Del Close, which is, you know, both at the time and in hindsight, life-changing. You know, that was a really interesting story. That was great. It was a great story that I wasn't aware of. I mean, I only knew it as like, oh, yeah, I ran into Del Close's. But the way he laid it out, like, oh, my God, that's a huge deal.
Does he run into Del at the bookstore? Is that the story?
Yes.
Yeah, in Chicago? Yeah. For those who don't know, who is Del Close, David? Just can you contextualize Del?
Del Close is a legend in improvisation, and basically the philosophy and structure of improv as we know it now, and sketch, I should say, improv going to sketch. He was the guy who developed all of those philosophies and those exercises and, you know, what ended up becoming Second City. He worked at Second City as we know it now, the Groundlings, Improv Olympic, UCB. He's the guy who started the Herald. And, but he was like a kind of, as I understand it, kind of like a druggy fuck up genius, you know, as are so many people in the arts, but his influence, I mean, reaches around the world.
Yeah. Do you have any take on why Bob may have had some? I appreciate that Bob's interest was sketch, like for something. Mm-hmm. Everyone has something that speaks to them. Mm-hmm. Bob was really intrigued by that, but there is a run in his book, as I recall. It's been a few months since I read it, but where he kind of takes out a couple of comedians. Like name comedians, just being like, that was not my style and I didn't like it. He's talking about the 80s comedy boom, I think, really. Mm-hmm. Do you know where his, is there anything to his relative disdain for stand-up? Like, again, I don't think it's disdain. That's the wrong word. But in that run, he kind of is like, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be like those guys because they were the stars and I didn't like them. But do you know where that may have come from? Is there something about stand-up versus sketch that can be extrapolated from that?
I don't know specifically. I mean, he'd have to answer that, but I think he's good at stand up. I mean, if he I can tell you if he applied himself to be his third grade teacher, if he applied himself to stand up, he would be a great stand up. And he's a good writer. I don't think he has a tremendous amount of confidence in it. In himself as a stand-up, but also sketch is a very different thing, and you get to, there's characters, there's a story, there's an arc. It's not a monologue. It's a different thing, and they sketch as a format out of all the other possible formats suited his sensibility better than. Certainly stand up or anything else. And he's right. We shared that, I mean, stronger than, I mean, disdain, contempt, disgust, repulsion of those certain kinds of acts, especially in the 80s, early 90s. Because if you're listening to this now and you're younger, the world of stand-up and comedy is what it is and feels like it's always been that way, but it wasn't. And in the 80s, there was a very real, palpable comedy boom, and it was a big deal, and it had gone from almost seemingly overnight, of course it wasn't overnight, but felt that way to some people, like where comedy was just a sort of you know, second cousin of the entertainment world, there weren't that many stand-ups, and most of them, the vast majority that you'd see on the limited availability of The Tonight Show or something like that, were kind of softer,
yeah,
corny, or doing these bad kind of arch characters. And then, you know, there was this huge comedy boom, and in that comedy boom, there were people who, for the first time, said, I'm going to use stand-up as a vehicle. I'm not necessarily talented, and I'm not that funny, and I'm not, but I want to do sitcoms or whatever the thing is, yeah, and I can use stand-up as a vehicle to get me there. And some people were successful at that. And they, it wasn't intuitive, it wasn't an innate thing, it wasn't pure, it wasn't real. And you could tell immediately. I mean, you could suss it up immediately.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of those folks clogging everything up. And this is kind of where what we now know, because a journalist decided to phrase it this way, as the alternative comedy, which doesn't exist anymore. But back then, it sort of did, even though there was no name for it until somebody, some journalist somewhere named it. But it came out of that, and it came out of that contempt for that kind of stand-up comedy. And I think that kind of stand-up is what Bob is reacting to.
Is it the pretense of it? Is it the softness, as you say, of it? Is it the inherent careerism that's evident? Like, there seem to be a lot of things swirling around.
I think it's mostly just, I mean, you know, stand-up is a really hard thing to do, and it's very particular, and it's a, to be dramatic, if you suffer for your art, as some stand-ups do and have done, where you're just going through the grind of, like, awful show after awful show so you can get the stage time, so you can get better, and you're eating it and bombing night after night. And sometimes with, you're not just, there's not just no reaction. There's a kind of negative, sometimes with an undercurrent of violence, depending on where you are in the country, of reaction to your stuff. And it's hard. It's psychologically a hard thing to do. And for people who are dedicated to the art and craft of stand-up, to see people roll in with their, you know, kind of just parroting or aping the plugging it in, like, oh, I'll change my cadence to be like this for this joke, and it's just there's no heart or soul to it. It's false, and it's and to see that, and then to see that work and to see that be successful is disheartening. It's hard. So that's kind of what I'm talking about is, you know, again, like to start from nothing and to be a stand up and to, I mean, it is a fucking grind, and you don't make any money. I mean, you lose money for a couple of years, and it's hard.
Yeah. No, you know? I gather that. Dana Gould, like, I hate to keep dropping names of a recent guest, but Dana Gould was on the show as well recently.
And he's a great comic. Great, great, great.
Absolutely.
Great comic.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
He made a point of, I was asking him about the Ben Stiller show, which was very deeply meaningful to me when it came out, and I was, must have been 14, 15, 16. And anyway, I was asking him about it just because I knew he was associated with it. He made a point of saying that that was the show, that was the period where he basically introduced you and Bob. Is that about right? Does that ring true to you?
That, I'm not sure about that. I the very first time I met Bob was with, or through Janine Garofalo, and he, I think he writes about it in the book, and it's kind of one of those stories that we've told over the years, and it's in the Mr. Show book, and it's in his book, and I'm sure it'll be in my book when I do one, but,
You've done one. Don't sell yourself.
No, short. No,
I love that book.
But I mean,
that's
like
a great book, your book.
Well, thank you.
I drink for a reason. Am I saying that right? I don't have it in front of me.
That's right. Yeah. I drink for a reason.
Yeah. You know what?
I'll do a memoir. Yeah.
I must backtrack. Dana told me, I just remembered. Sorry, I'm riffing here. He introduced Judd Apatow to Ben Stiller. Sorry, I'm remembering the quote now. He says that you and Bob started kind of working together, probably through Janine, on the Ben Stiller show. That might have been the first time you started really working together. Is that more accurate?
That is more accurate, but still not quite accurate.
Okay,
it is, but much more accurate. Very briefly, I was out in L.A. The Stiller show hadn't started yet. I was crashing on Janine Garofalo, who's the godmother of all of us. I was crashing on her couch. She's like, oh, I know this guy is really funny. You'd like him. And I was kind of bored, and I had and I was like, oh, maybe I can play basketball. And she's like, oh, I have a friend, Bob, plays basketball,
right.
Whatever. And it's funny when he tells it too, because I have my point of view and he has his point of view, but he left this, the door was open and there was a screen door that was closed. He was watching TV. He was eating a sandwich on a chair and watching some TV. And he barely even pulled his head back to look at us. And I just felt like I was 8 years old, like on his steps with my basketball. Like, oh, all right, I guess I'll go home. And then months and months and months later, maybe a year later, whenever it was, probably a year later, I was a mid-season replacement. I was living in Boston. I came out to write on the Ben Stiller show and just baptism by fire. And Bob was a dick to me, as he has noted. He noted, when we do interviews, he's noted it. He was really like kind of shitty to me. And we didn't really connect because he didn't kind of allow that. And then we had so many mutual friends and we continued to work together, and then things kind of softened a bit. And then I remember the first time that we connected in a way that is a way that we've remained connected, which is at a party at Laura Milligan's house. We were in the kitchen. I remember this well. And we started riffing what became the Mr. Show sketch about the Dougie, the flying English guy with the pan. He's the infomercial guy.
Yeah, right.
The hitter with the pan or whatever.
The guy who hits people in the head with the pan. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And we riffed that. And it was... And that's another thing that when you to make it an analogy to when you have chemistry with a woman, you meet wherever, at a bar, party, wherever the place is, and there's a definite chemistry and you're talking and you're just on, you know?
Yeah.
That thing, when your relationship with your wife made that turn, like just on, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And Bob and I just had that connection. We're riffing this really funny thing and really interesting. The riff that became a sketch is just traveling in this really funny way, and we're starting to anticipate where the other person's going, and that's a very important key element. And then I was doing stand-up at the Improv in Santa Monica, and he was doing his one-man show, and I had in Santa Monica the same kind of little Third Street Promenade area there, and I had time before my set, and I went down and I saw him do his show that he was doing in Chicago before he ever moved out to LA. And I had a show in Boston called Cross Comedy where we did kind of these very interesting sort of, you know, fucking with the audience type stuff.
Yeah.
And I saw 15-20 minutes of that, and I was like, oh, this is really clever and interesting, and there's kind of theatrical elements to the comedy and surprises. It was the first time I went, oh, you know what? I think he'd like my stand-up. I think, and I talked to him and he came over and he saw my set. And, I had kind of elements of like, before I was known, I would go up as different, I'd have a different name or, you know, I'd go up as different characters and try to trick the audience and make them uncomfortable. And then we'd really hit it off from that point forward.
I appreciate that background. So where I was coming from with reading the book and then revisiting Mr. Show, this comes at the same time that I'm catching my wife up on Better Call Saul, because I'm all up to date, but now I'm 3-4 times through these seasons. So we're only, as of last night, we're about to start season 4. Anyway, where the connection
well, no,
for me...
Well, no spoiler alerts, because I'm early in this season. 6.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I've only seen one episode.
I'm not going to say I don't spoil anything. Yeah. And I won't spoil a thing. My point, though, is this. In rewatching Mr. Show, and I know this about you because of Todd Margaret, because of Arrested Development, all the films you've done, the acting on Mr. Show is out of this world. So there's the comedy that's fucking funny and sharp, but I'm like, oh, because I think a lot of us were like, why is Bob Odenkirk on Breaking Bad? Not me. Sorry. I bet some people are like, what the hell is this show? Why are there all these comedians on it? Something about Vince Gilligan and that universe. He respects comedians and he knows they're integral to telling that kind of story. I mean, Cranston as well, I think, was a comedic actor, really, when you think about
it. Yeah, came from Malcolm in the Middle.
And Seinfeld. Yeah, like all the stuff he had done, really, that he was known for. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a real comedic lilt to it. So it made sense on that level. But Bob's acting is out of hand. But then I was like, wait a minute. David's acting is also out of hand. Like, just a high level of acting and performance on Mr. Show, if I may say. And I guess I'm just curious. I know you as comedians. Did you do any acting exercises? Did you do any acting training to get there? Because the way you get to places with those that's phenomenal to me.
I don't think Bob did, and I didn't really. I mean, I went to a school of the arts when I was in high school. I transferred in 10th grade and went to a school of the arts, a magnet school. You know, still public school, but concentrated on that. So, you know, instead of like gym or whatever, you have 3 hours of the day is based on these other concentrations. And I, you know, I did some like acting stuff there and had a teacher, you know, there was an acting teacher, but I didn't go to like, you know, acting school.
No Juilliard for you. Okay, got
it. No Juilliard. I would have. I'm not saying it's bad. You know, I definitely would have. I'm sure I could do it now and learn and become a better actor, I'm sure.
I think of you as very obvious. Okay, and I don't know where I'm coming from.
And let me say, I appreciate your saying that. That's a very nice thing to say and a nice observation.
Did you feel that as you were doing Mr. Show, or if you look back on it, or when you revisited?
Yes, I did. I the year there, I was very vocal, I still am, about... I don't know what year it was. It was probably 97 or 98. And we did a sketch called Prenatal Pageants. And Bob's acting in that it shows you everything that he was going to become. He's really, really good in it. It's a comedy sketch, but it's grounded. It's got empathy. I think our characters had a lot of, there was some pathos to it. And to most of our characters, you know, and he's just great in that. And I remember that year we were nominated for, I believe, a writing Emmy. I think we got nominated for like over the years, maybe like 3 or 4 Emmys. But it was like writing and music. And I remember Bob, I remember I was being particularly annoyed because Bob wasn't recognized and sketch actors just weren't recognized as in the acting categories, you know, comedic performance, I think they would call it. And the winner that year was Dennis Miller, who had his talk show. It was like he'd do like a monologue up front, and then he would have a guest, and he'd talk to the guest for the bulk of the show, and then he would do these kind of, I don't know, photo funnies things where he'd stand by a monitor and there'd be like photos from the news and he would comment.
I watched that show. I will say it was on for a short period. It got canceled, which by the way, one of the few instances, well, I guess it happened with Conan too, where the host knew he was canceled, but still got to do a week of shows. And it, I'm sorry. I know Dennis is whatever, but,
this was the HBO show.
Oh, sorry. Different show. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Not his talk show. This was like weekly or Dennis, do like 10 of them.
Dennis Miller Live or whatever it was called, probably. Yeah. Okay.
I don't remember that. Anyway, but I remember he won the Emmy for Best Comedic Performance the same year that Bob did not just Prenatal Pageants, but, you know, I don't know, 60 characters or whatever. Yeah. And it just really always bothered me. And this is not a knock on Dennis Miller, just the idea that you're just delivering
it's being himself.
Jokes that people wrote then interviewing somebody. And like, that is a better performance than what Bob did in prenatal pageants. I would disagree.
Well, again, it's rather, I don't mean to just, butter you up here. The singing too. You mentioned the music stuff.
All right.
No, your singing is fantastic. You got a great singing voice, David, if I might say. I'm going to make you uncomfortable. But you have to understand, I'm rewatching Mr. Show. It's the context is, we've talked a few times now. I'm a fan of yours. But just immersing myself back in the world, I'm like, look at all these guys are so talented. And it totally makes Better Call Saul. Which I will admit to you, I was initially like, they're spinning off Breaking Bad. How are they going to do that? And then I saw it, and it's the best thing I've ever, it's one of the best things I've ever seen.
Oh, of course.
Of course this makes sense. Yeah. So all I'm getting at is I feel like you two are very, very talented and maybe unheralded for your various talents. And all I was also going to get to there is I think you're thought of rather as very talented writers and comedians, but with the acting and the performative skills on display, you just make it seem so easy. So that's why I was asking, easier than most, I will say, comedians who end up in acting situations. And I don't know what that's a testament to. I think maybe it could be Haley's Comet. You're just two uniquely talented guys, and that's what you were able to do.
You've discovered our secret. It is, in fact, Haley's Comet.
You and Bob confer about things. He sent you galleys. Have you had any role? Does he confer with you about Better Call Saul in any way?
No.
Not
in any way. Nor should he. I make him swear to secrecy before I can watch it all.
Oh, okay.
Which he's been very good about. Because I love the show. It's a really good show.
It's phenomenal. Okay.
And the fact after last whenever it came out, but season 5, that Rae Seahorn didn't get nominated, it will always also bother me. Like, she was so, everybody's good in the show, but Rae's in particular, the way that Kim Wexler evolves and the nuances of, way more than any other character on that show. Like, to watch Kim's change is really, she's just great. She's really great.
I'm currently Team Kim, but I'm dreading where this is going because of
don't say
no. I just mean generally.
Yeah.
Did you watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so you know that all I'm getting at is Kim's not in Breaking Bad, so we don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But we're seeing this.
I see. Yeah.
Character develop. That's what I'm. Phenomenal. I do you have any insight? Why are people in the critics' realm, maybe? I don't think they're Better Call Saul is being ignored, but why? Why isn't Rae? Why aren't they winning everything? Do you have any insight?
I don't have insight, but I can offer an opinion. I think, there used to be, like, the TV landscape when Breaking Bad was around was much different than it is now. And there's a glut of stuff out there. I can't tell you why Rae, I don't know, or she needs to pay more money to a publicist or however this shit works. I don't know how it works. It's not my world. People go out and actively campaign for that stuff. People just don't physically have the time to look at every single performance. There used to be how many dramas were there in a year? Were there 48 that you could cull through? Back when Breaking Bad was happening, maybe there were like 69, 70, and now what are there, 240? And you're supposed to look at every single episode and every single performance, and
it's a series of its time, because I think in the same episode it's a comedy, it's a drama, it's a murder mystery. I think sometimes when you can't, this is, you're talking about all comedy, and people add that prefix to stuff if they don't get it. I think, a lot of the time. And I feel like that show is one that just throughout the episode, you're going to laugh. You're going to be like, what the fuck? You're going to like it's. And I think that can create this like, what is this? What am I? What like you see the absurd categories they end up in. even like I could see yeah. Bob and I don't maybe this has happened. I'm riffing here, but I would if he's nominated for best comedic performance in Better Call Saul.
Well, that wouldn't happen. They wouldn't submit him for that. You can only
right,
submit
of course.
For
oh right, of course. It's yeah.
It anyway. Would be dramatic. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. All this to say, it's a wonderful show. I'm proud. I'm happy. I was going to say like a papa. I'm proud of you and but I'm very happy for both of you. What is next for you, David? You've got this special out that's phenomenal. OfficialDavidCross.com to watch. I'm from the future. I hope I'm just making that up. That's the right title, right? I said it right.
Yeah, I'm from the future.
What's yeah. next for you? Also, within that, what's next for you is my main question. But I've watched your special. Is it going to be? Is it available on audio platforms as well?
It will be. Yeah, we're going to release it through 800 Pound Gorilla. And
nice.
There's certain kind of like you have to. I don't know all the stuff, but it has to be on this thing for X amount of time, and then you can put it on this thing for... I don't know how it works, but it'll be available shortly.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
what was I going to say? So Bob and I and his brother Bill wrote this... pitched this show, sold it to... had a lot of interest, and then basically... Paramount Plus had the best offer, so we wrote. It's a limited series designed to be a limited series about cult leaders. It's specifically two cult leaders, one played by Bob, one played by myself, vying for these different people. And then, but it's got a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, a limited series, and we. Wrote, commissioned to write the first four scripts, and they have them. They've had them for about 3 weeks now, and they're waiting to decide. They have, I don't know why, but in most TV, they have, several months to decide whether to go further with it. And, and so the ball is in their court, as it were, and we're waiting to find out if Paramount Plus is going to pick it up and order it. And then if so, we will immediately get to writing the next four episodes, and we have them all beat out. We have them all plotted.
Oh, nice.
We know where everything goes. We're very happy with the scripts we wrote. A lot of potential. I mean, just it's already funny on paper, but then when you think about getting on set, and Jason Wolliner would be directing it, and he's great, and we've worked with him before, and then just whatever we come up with on set and how amazing it could be. It could be really special. So we're waiting to find out about that. And if that doesn't get picked up, then I will go into overdrive on my stand-up. I just started doing the run of shows that I've done for the last three tours, which is I just do them here in Brooklyn. They're called Shooting the Shit, Seeing What Sticks. And if you're interested, if you're in New York, you can go to my website and see where I'm doing those shows. And it's just me. I record everything, and it's really pretty loose, and I'm riffing and talking about stuff. And it's eventually the stuff that I'm doing is what ends up being the tour, right. the set that I do on the tour. And it kind of goes in three phases. And I just started phase one, which is really loose. You have some special guests. As I said, I tape everything, and I go, "Oh, that's a funny riff, and this could." And then it becomes material, you know. But the beginning part, they're very, very loose and very fun. Hmm. And then there's really three phases to it. So I'm in phase one of that. But if the show doesn't get picked up, then I will be doing 2 to 3 sets a night for a month and a half. And then, getting something ready to go out on tour.
That's lovely. I mean, there's a point in the new special where you talk about how great it is to be back on stage. I appreciate how hard it was for you to be off of it. So I'm happy.
Fish, a year and a half.
Yeah, no.
A year and a half. A year and a half. That is the longest. I started doing stand-up. The first time I did it was the week before my 18th birthday. And in that time period, I don't know that there's probably the longest time was probably 3 months, and that seemed like an eternity. So a year and a half without getting to do stand-up was brutal.
You make a very, very funny joke about stand-up comedians and narcissism in the special, which I enjoyed. And but what is it about?
It's true.
What is it about it that you miss so much? Was it the crowd interaction? I know it's your main expression, but can you pinpoint it? Like, what was it that you missed?
I mean, very, very much it was about, and again, addressing some of the narcissism of it, which is, you know, at its core, it's like, listen to me, you know, pay attention to me. Yeah. it's a really fulfilling, satisfying creative process to go, and with the audience, and I do mean that sincerely, it's when I'm initially doing these things, it's a dialogue, yeah, you know, yeah. It eventually becomes a monologue, but it starts out as a dialogue. And, you know, I'm a bit of a chatty Cathy, and, you know, to be able to go out, and if you can't go to a pub and sit around and talk politics and, you know, topical shit with your friends and your friends' friends who might be strangers at the beginning of the evening, but, you know, it kind of replaces that in a sense. And it's always an enjoyable process, and it's enjoyable for me to find these things on stage to go, oh, that's what this bit is about. Yeah. It's not about this. I thought it was about this. It's actually about this. Yeah. And just performing. I mean, there's no substitute for it.
Yeah.
Zero. None.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for stand-up.
Well, I can see that. I can vaguely relate to that on the one hand, but I'll just say, as I said already, the special is wonderful. It's great to see you, I think, exuding joy to be back on stage. I know you guard it a little bit, but I it's really lovely, and the special is fantastic. David, before we go, we mentioned your website a few times, officialdavidcross.com. Where else can people go to learn more about your comings and goings? I know you're fairly active on Twitter, for one thing.
Don't go to Twitter. I'm barely on there.
I knew about the shows you were just talking about because I looked at your Twitter yesterday.
Oh, you know what? That's true. I have a guy who, when there's like kind of official stuff, will put that out there, like
social media.
He's the guy who runs the website.
Right. Okay.
Or maintains the website, I should say. But he's he's in St. Louis. We're like, hey, Brendan, can you tell? Because I'm also technically really dumb, really bad. That's the main reason why I had a kid, so that she can grow up and teach me how to do these things.
You seem adept to me, but yeah.
No, I'm not. I am not. But so yes, on Twitter you can find some for sure. Yeah, okay. Twitter. And then if you go to my website, you can sign up for the mailing list, and we send everybody on that list info for things that are happening.
Okay.
But yeah, man, thank you so much. Thanks for your time and all that. And good talking to you again.
Yeah, I appreciate it, David. You know, I love you very much, and I'm glad you're working and happy. So best of luck with everything in the future.
All right, man. Thank you very much.
Very, very special thanks again to David Cross for coming back on this show, this time to appear on the 694th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me, sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on the Facebook there if you want to. You can follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. Also, please consider visiting patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. All of the work that is done to make the show is primarily compensated by you, those of you who contribute to the Patreon. It really means a lot that you do that at all. It's a modest Patreon in the grand scheme of things, but it means the world. And you know, you hope at some point maybe it'll sustain my life and my family, but what are you going to do? Right now that's not happening, but still, labor of love. I know you contribute to it. from some sort of labor of love perspective, too. It means a lot. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, sometimes derived from new interviews. Sometimes I dig into my archives and I post things there. So I appreciate that. That's what you get for $6 or more a month. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks in advance for even considering contributing. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this podcast. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with David Cross. Again, this is, I believe, David's third appearance on this show. It means the world. It just means the world to me. I've been a fan for so, so long. So thank you, David, if you're still listening. If you listened back at all, I doubt you did. But thank you, David. If you know David and you hear this, tell him I said thanks several times at the end of the episode as well. And speaking of thanks, thank you for listening, as I say. Thank you for subscribing to this podcast or following it and telling your friends all about it, spreading the word about it. That helps a lot as well. Otherwise, I hope you're well. Be safe. Be kind. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.